This morning I'll be reading from Mark 7, verses 1 through 23. That which defiles. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of their elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands?" He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions." And he continued, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and 'Anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death.' But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is korban, that is, devoted to God, then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And you do many things like that." Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them." After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into their heart, but into their stomach, and then out of the body." In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, "What comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person."
Good morning. So after a couple week break, we're back in the Gospel of Mark. And I think if honestly, I feel this way, even just hearing this passage again. When we first hear this passage, I think it's easy to think, what in the world does this have to do with me? So it feels like, if you were listening, it feels like we're kind of watching a debate that is far removed from our culture, from our lives today. I'm guessing not many of us spent a whole lot of time this week on questions regarding, are we defiled? I'm guessing not a lot of us spent a lot of time this week thinking about, did we eat clean or unclean food? So I get it. What in the world does this have to do with us today? I think, hang with me here, I think actually it has some pretty powerful ways to speak into our lives. Just a little bit leading up to this passage, we've had some spectacular miracles. We've had the feeding of 5,000. We've had the Jesus walking on water. That was the last story. And now there's this really abrupt change in scenery. And as I say, we find ourselves kind of on the sideline of this sparring that's going on between Jesus and these religious leaders. And as you watch this, it's easy to forget kind of what, as we go into this, what is the central issue here? And this is what kind of is at the heart. What is it that makes a person unclean? So what defiles a person? Is it something from the outside? In other words, does a contaminant from outside the human body come inside and that then defile the person? Or is it from the inside? Is the contaminant actually within the heart, and that's what defiles a person? And you're thinking, like, neither. I don't think either one of those things defile us. hang with me. I think one of the first challenges we have with this passage is we do not live in a culture with strong ritual boundaries around food. Last weekend, I took my boys and Abel camping out in PA, and we were hiking, and Abel noticed that there weren't any snakes. I mean, I'm sure there were snakes there, but he wasn't seeing a lot of snakes. And I asked him, "Hey, Abel, do you eat snakes?" And he's like, "Oh, I've eaten snakes many times." And I was surprised, not because he had eaten snakes, but because when I was in Benin, I had this experience where I was out on a really rural farm with this farmer, a very innovative farmer that had this farm where he'd invite young men from the region to come out and learn about sustainable agriculture. And one day, the head farmer was away, and while he was away, the students caught a snake and they cooked it up. And I'm pretty sure I tried it. I'm pretty sure it was fine. It was quite good. But when Pascal got back, he was not happy at all that they'd been eating the snake. And so when Abel said, "Oh yeah, I eat snakes, that's no problem," I thought, "Well, what's going on there?" And he explained to me, well, Pascal is part of a different ethnic group. He's Fon. And for the Fon, that snake is a fetish for them. It's almost like a god to them. And that's why they don't eat it. So his students had crossed this ritual boundary in his mind. We don't really have this in our culture. The closest I have come to experience this was a number of years ago in our last church community when someone brought possum to our carry-in meal. This is a true story. It really riled some people up, especially this one woman. It's the only time, after having been in the church all my life, that I heard someone pull out the "all foods are clean" line. Lots of conflicts in church. I'm sure you've been part of them. Not usually whether you can bring possum to a carry-in meal. If I had you over for dinner, you know, what I serve you might not be your first choice, but I doubt you're going to worry about it being unclean. And when you walk into my house and I show you where the sink is, I'm going to encourage you to wash your hands, but that's for hygienic purposes, right? It's not because I think you have brought in ritual uncleanliness into my house. But in the passage today, that the religious leaders, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they're essentially calling out Jesus' disciples. And they're calling them out because they're doing something that's defiling. They're eating with unwashed hands. So don't think hygiene here. Don't think that like Peter had like dirt under his fingernails and the Pharisees were grossed out by that. They're upset because, as Mark tells us, they're eating with hands that are defiled, that are ceremonially unclean, a different kind of dirty. And the washing these hands by the religious leaders was a way to symbolize that they were trying to purify themselves before coming to God. So under the Levitical law, under the Old Testament law, there were all kinds of ways a person could become unclean. And we've actually seen a number of these as we've gone through Mark. You can by bleeding, that's a way you can become unclean for a woman. A leper is unclean, a dead corpse is unclean, and Mark explains here, if someone's out at the marketplace and they bump into a Gentile, they can actually become unclean that way. And so before they eat, they need to wash their hands. So we do kind of some similar things in our culture. For example, we typically bow our heads, or a lot of times people used to kneel before they prayed. It's not that we think that by bowing our heads that opens up God to hear us, or by kneeling then God will listen to us more. But it's a kind of a way of physically acting out something, showing through our bodies that we're approaching God with humility and reverence. And so through these rituals, this washing of the hands, the Pharisees are reminding them that God is pure and that God demands purity of his people, that they need to serve God with clean hands and an upright heart. The other thing these rituals did is they marked out the Jewish people from other people. So, for example, these washing the hands reinforced that they were different. They were distinct from the other people around them. And they were doing this at a time when Greek and Roman culture was seeping its way into Jewish culture. And so this was another way of reminding them that we are separate. So here's what I want you to see right now. It's really easy to hear this and think these guys are ridiculous, the Pharisees. They're legalistic. They're judgmental. They have these silly rules about cups and bowls. It's really easy to create a caricature of them. But if we do that, we miss a couple things. One, we miss these guys have good intentions. They're striving for purity. They're trying to be holy. They're trying to take seriously the command in Leviticus 19:2 to be holy to the Lord. And that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing even for us. I think holiness is something nowadays, maybe even in our tradition, that we don't tend to stress as much. But in 1 Peter we read, "But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, be holy because I am holy." Be holy in all you do. Be pure in all you do. So these, their intentions were good. They're striving for holiness, the Pharisees and the teachers in the law. Secondly, I think the reality is that every community has boundaries. Even if a community sets out to say, we're going to be a community that has no boundaries, like if you're a person that comes in that community and you want boundaries, well, you're out, right? You cannot avoid having boundaries in a community. Some boundaries are bad, some boundaries are good, but they play a role. They give us a sense of who we are. I think I see this with my kids. A lot of times my kids are figuring out who are we as the Peterson family or as followers of Jesus Christ. And some of the ways they do this is by noticing what do we do that others don't, and what do others do that we don't. And they ask questions about that. A lot of times they'll ask, is that person a Christian? And when they ask those questions, they're not asking them in a judgmental way. They're trying to sort out who are we. They're trying to gain a sense of identity of who we are. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law have these boundaries, have these traditions, and they notice that that Jesus and his disciples are not following them. And they say, hey, why don't you guys live according to these traditions? So there's this line, traditions of the elders. And again, what that is that back then there was the Torah, there was the written law that we find in the Old Testament, the first five books of the Bible. But then there was also this oral tradition that we called the tradition of the elders, and that was an unwritten law. And what that did was that filled in a lot of the gaps and silences. So oftentimes these purity laws in Leviticus and Numbers were pretty ambiguous, so this actually gave some clear instruction on what to actually do with those laws. But what happened over time is that the Pharisees began to substitute their own traditions, this oral tradition that had been passed down, for the actual written will of God. So like boundaries, traditions have their place. Traditions are not bad in themselves. For example, if I said to you, like, starting next Sunday, we're going to meet at 3 p.m., I have a feeling some people would not be happy. But like, would you be able to quote a New Testament verse to me on why we should not be meeting at 3 p.m.? No, you would say, that's not what we do. That would be really confusing. What do we meet 3 o'clock this way, and then we 10:30, and then that just wouldn't work, right? People wouldn't be happy, and they would, understandably, it would be really hard to function as a church community without any of these traditions. Traditions also strengthen our identity. I think Mennonites have a lot of those. I'm thinking of my own. I grew up in a church tradition where we did not use instruments, where all the music was a cappella, and four-part harmony was very important, probably similar to some of you. And all growing up, whenever someone would ask me where I went to church, and I said, I go to the Church of Christ, almost always the next question was, are you guys the ones that don't use instruments? Almost always. And looking back, I see the a cappella tradition that I grew up in is such a gift. It was such a beautiful tradition. Somehow I managed to learn avoiding to sing in that tradition. I don't know exactly how. But man, you get, and the same could be said about Mennonites, but I'm going to say it about Church of Christ. You get a couple thousand Church of Christ people in an auditorium singing a cappella, and it's like makes your spine tingle. It's just amazing. I know you have had similar experiences where you get a couple hundreds or thousands of people singing a cappella, and it's an amazing thing. What I didn't understand was when someone tried to explain to me that's the only way to do it. So I was, to be honest with you, I had very little interest in the Bible as a kid, minimal interest in church. But even to me, I was like, that doesn't seem to jive very well. Like, that's the only way. So there's all these instruments in the Old Testament, but that all, okay, all right, I don't get it. But sometimes someone would try to explain, this is really the way that we're supposed to do this. Traditions are not bad in themselves, but when they begin to become an idol or they begin to supersede the actual will of God, that becomes a problem. Or when those traditions become walls, when they begin to shut people off from the community. I was listening to a pastor recently. So he pastored for a long time and then stepped back from pastoring. and he's going to go visit a church. And so I think he went over near Pittsburgh somewhere. Shows up, walks down. If you haven't been to a new church lately, it's kind of nerve-wracking. Like whenever you're visiting, you feel very out of your element. You feel nervous. You kind of want people to talk to you, but you kind of don't want people to talk to you. It's just a nerve-wracking experience to me. And so he goes to this church, walks up, sits down, I think up towards the front. Sure enough, a woman comes by and says, "You're in my seat." It's like classic, classic. Is it wrong to have a regular church at seated church? No. Is it wrong when your regular seated church becomes more important than welcoming the visitor? Like, absolutely. I think most of us would agree with that. At this point, you've lost the heart of what church is, what the point of you gathering is all about. And Jesus in this passage is starting to push back against some of those traditions and boundaries. He's starting to see some of these ways that these human traditions, you're following them, but you're missing really what's at the heart of God. As one commentator put, I like this, he said, Jesus is like those who want to run church for those who do not yet attend. Let me read that again. Jesus is like people who want to run church for those who are not yet part of it. So Jesus is thinking about the outside. How do we bring these people in rather than hold them out? And remember, we need to keep remembering these Pharisees have good intentions. You can't see these guys as caricatures. They have good intentions. They're seeking holiness and purity and clean hearts. They're seeking to please God. You can have really, really good intentions. You can be trying to please God. And in the process, you can mistake those traditions for the will of God. And through your good intentions, rather than making space for people, you can actually build up walls that keep people out. So I think a couple questions, we talked a little bit about this actually in our class this morning. I think a couple questions I think we need to be asking ourselves on a regular basis is, where might we be substituting tradition for the will of God? Where might we be, in obeying all these regulations and rules and all these correct doctrines, where might we be missing really what's at the heart of God? And secondly, are we just running a church for ourselves? Or are we running a church for those who are not yet here? And so we need to ask ourselves, are there subtle and unsubtle ways that we communicate that people are either welcome or not welcome here? And that's hard. I think that, if we're totally honest, this is hard. It's hard to get a balance right. So a community with no boundaries and no tradition, no identity, no doctrines, is really not much of a community to invite someone into. It doesn't really have much. It's not a robust community. I think there's a danger there. When you just like wipe everything away, that's a danger. But it's also a danger when you create these barriers that keep people out. So how do we run the church for people who are not here yet? I think that's a question we need to be asking ourselves. Okay, Jesus, he has a pretty harsh response. It doesn't seem like he actually answers their question directly, but it's kind of like they say, hey, wash your hands, sinner, and Jesus' response is, hey, purify your hearts, you double-minded. You have let go of the commands of God, and you're holding on to human tradition. So Jesus then, he gives his own example. How does human tradition then supersede the will of God? And he gives this example about Corban. And this is like kind of confusing. We don't know what Corban is usually. Corban means offering in Hebrew. And so what would happen is a person could dedicate their goods or their property to God, and it would be calling it Corban. But the reality is they kept control over that property. So something similar today, for example, you can set up a trust fund. And you can give all your assets to that trust fund, but you can make yourself the beneficiary of that trust fund, and so you essentially still control all those assets. So that's kind of a little bit what's happening, not exactly, but that's a little bit what's happening here. So Jesus is saying, you're declaring this Corban, you're devoting it to God, but you're doing it to get around helping your mother and father. It's like saying, like, Mom and Dad, I would love to help you, but, you know, everything I have is devoted to God. I'm sorry, I'd love to help you. I can't break this oath. So basically it becomes a loophole. It becomes a way of getting around doing one of the commandments in the Ten Commandments, which is honoring your father and mother. And that's a problem. This is how human tradition becomes the enemy of God's word. How that tradition can actually move a person away from the will of God. So then after he gives that example, he kind of pivots back to this, this original question about defilement. So again, what is it that makes a person clean and unclean? What defiles a person? Is it something from the outside or the inside? And Jesus says to his disciples, don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into their heart, but into their stomach, and then out of their body. So it's kind of this really, actually this earthy description in Greek. It's the food goes into your mouth, it goes in your stomach, and then out into the latrine. And he's saying, that's not what defiles a person. And we have this little, like Mark, if you've been watching Mark rarely does editorial comments. So mostly Mark just, he has the action, he has Jesus' words, he has the disciples' words. He doesn't put in his own commentary, but here he actually does. He says, in saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. So what's Mark is saying is that these Old Testament laws on what you can eat, you can't eat pork, you can't eat camel, you can't eat rabbit, these are no longer binding. And he's probably having to say this because in this community that Mark is writing to 30 years after this, they're still struggling with this issue. This was a huge issue. Is the Old Testament dietary laws still binding or are they not? And we learn that in Acts and in Paul's letters, they're going to continue to struggle with this for a long time. And Jesus is saying here, or Mark's saying that Jesus is saying, no, that's not what makes a person unclean. And then he gives this long list of things that do make a person unclean: sexual immorality, theft, murder, and so on. So here's the answer to our question. How is a person made unclean? Jesus says it's from the inside. It's from inside the heart. And I think that's easy to miss because notice that Jesus actually does care about defilement. He doesn't say, like, in the old days we had these funny little things and these kind of primitive ideas about cleanliness and non-cleanliness, and we've moved beyond that. No, he says Jesus is actually concerned about cleanliness. He's concerned about impurity, but he's concerned about a kind that you can't wash off your hands. So in some ways it's easy to read this passage and think, like, I'm so glad we're free from all this, like, washing our cups and kettles, and I'm so glad we can eat bacon on Sunday morning. I'm so glad that we've been freed from all these things. But what's easy to miss is that rather than alleviating the demand for purity, Jesus is actually sharpening it. So think about, I kind of did this myself, but you may not want to, but think about the last week. Like, anyone struggle with sexual immorality in their minds this last week? Anyone struggle with greed? Anyone struggle with wanting just a little bit more money this week? Malice. Anyone struggle? I'm sure nobody is struggling with this right now. Any ill will towards a person this week? Deceit. Anyone stretch the truth just a little bit this week? Just a little white lie? Arrogance. Did you look down on anybody? So think about it this way. If I gave, not that I have the power to do this, but if I gave you two paths, all right? Here's the first path. Go out this week and wash your hands every time you eat. Wash your pitchers and your cups and your kettles. Don't eat camel or pork, and you're good. You're clean, all right? You come back next week, we'll ask you, the greeter will ask you, are you pure? You say, yes, I followed all this. Or you can take the second path. Have zero impure thoughts. Have no moment of greed, no moment of feeling better than someone else, no stretching the truth, no ill will towards someone, no lustful thoughts, and you're going clean. Which one do you want? Which path do you take? I mean, somehow, like, the washing the kettles, like, sounds better all the time. We think it's great that Jesus declared all these foods clean, but we miss that, man, Jesus is actually asking for something harder. Who in the world could possibly follow this? Who in the world could possibly remain undefiled? See, the Pharisees and Jesus, they have different ideas about what makes a person unclean, but they agree that everyone needs cleansing, that we are unclean, that we are defiled. And think about it, because that's not, I guess, as I said, that's not language you hear too often these days. Most, if we're totally honest, that language is slightly offensive to us. We don't like it. It sounds very primitive to us. But here's what I want to argue. That whether we use that language or not, we are desperate to be clean. That we are tirelessly scrubbing our hands, washing the outside, shielding ourselves from any contaminants in the pursuit of cleanness. Let me give you a couple examples. How are we doing this? It doesn't seem like we're doing this, but let me give you a couple examples. First is, the classic is religion. This is, I think, less prevalent in our culture now than it used to be, but religion is a wonderful way to try to clean yourself up from the outside. Religion provides you all these nice rituals that you can do. Like, I can show up for worship every Sunday. I can do it over Zoom or I can do it in person. And I can check that box. And I can feel pretty good. I can feel clean, in a sense, for doing that. Religion gives guidance on what to avoid. So Halloween's coming up, and almost every year someone reminds me of why I need to remind people at the church why they need to stay far away from Halloween. It makes us unclean. It defiles us. Religion tells us what kind of music to avoid. Like, how many stories do you know of someone who became a Christian and then they, like, burned all their CDs? I don't know what you do nowadays when it's all digital. Like, when you... I think a few people, it's true, like, you hear stories like, man, I threw it all in the trash, all the music, and then I think, like, 10 years later, you regret that because you realize there was some good music there, but you want to get rid of the contaminants on the outside. Religion tells us who to stay away from. Who are the people that might rub off on us, who might corrupt us? And here's the deal, here's the thing, none of these are really all bad. Showing up to worship on Sunday, not bad. Being careful about, like, being discerning, what is it in the wider culture that we think we want to adopt and what do we want to say no to? Not bad at all. Not bad at all. The problem, though, is if you use religion to clean yourself up, you're never going to feel very clean. And not only that, you're going to become a really judgmental person. Because here's the problem when you use religion to clean yourself up. You clean, you scrub, you scrub, you scrub, but you never feel clean enough. And so what you do is you've got to find someone who looks dirtier than you. You've got to find someone who's less clean than you. I think that's one of the reasons why religious people tend to be the most judgmental is because we're constantly trying to justify ourselves. Look, we may not be perfect, but we are cleaner than that guy or that gal. So here's a test for you. How does gossip make you feel? Like, when you hear about someone else's misfortune, if you're completely honest, how does it make you feel? Does it make you a little excited? So we have all kinds of ways of just, like, I want to know about this because I care about that person. And meanwhile, you're like, oh, please tell me more, please tell me more. Why is that? Because it makes us feel better about ourselves. We may not be clean, but that person is even more unclean than us. Another problem with using religion to clean yourself up is you're going to avoid hanging out with exactly the kind of people that Jesus hung out with. A guy named Roy Pearson puts it this way. It is a fact too long neglected that the church has in common with the chimney sweep. So a guy that sweeps the chimney. We had ours done a couple weeks ago. That it cannot do its job in comfortable surroundings with clean hands. In this sense, cleanliness is not next to godliness. Dirt is. Dirt, pain, sorrow, prejudice, injustice, and treachery. See what he's saying here? He's saying the church is like a chimney sweeper. If you want to be a chimney sweeper and you don't want to get your hands dirty, like, good luck with that, right? If you want to be the church and you don't want to get your hands dirty, good luck with that. Because you're going to avoid all the people that Jesus is actually trying to invite and bring in. The reality is, as members of the church, you're going to get mixed up in messes and with people that are messy lives, and you're not going to be able to avoid that. But if you would just continually attack the contaminant, if you think it's all coming from the outside, you're going to end up like the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. You're going to keep trying to clean yourself up. You're going to attend the church service, and you're going to go through the motions, and you're going to shield yourself from anything that contaminate you, anything that might get your hands dirty, and you're going to end up with a heart that's hard, that's untouched. So some people right now are thinking, "Phew, I'm off the hook. I don't even really necessarily want to be here right now." And if you gave me a choice of hanging out with, like, church people or people at the bar downtown, I might take the people at the bar downtown. Good riddance to religious legalism. Good riddance to primitive ways of thinking about defilement and inherent sinliness. I'm glad we can all just know that we are clean these days. And see, what I want to argue is that I don't think that's the case. I think even if we don't say it, even if we don't use religion to try to clean ourselves up, I think we're not clean. I think we still try to attack it from the outside, but we do it in other ways. Let me give you a couple examples how I think we try to feel clean. One of them, interestingly, I think, is through food. I know something about this from firsthand experience. When we had our first child, Neva, Christiana especially, but we spent massive amounts of time and energy making sure that Neva only had pure foods. No refined sugar, mostly organic, whole food. She made her own baby food. And if you asked us why, we would say, well, it's for her health, of course. But deep down, if you really kind of peeled through some of the layers, I think we had this idea that we could keep our daughter pure. That we could keep her clean. That we wouldn't taint her. You know, if it's true that you are what you eat, I did not want Neva to become Roundup. I spent 8 years working at an organic, sustainable farm. I'm a big proponent of clean food. Don't hear that. But I've also recognized that food can become a religion. It can become a way to try to cleanse yourself. Recently, our fourth son told us his favorite foods were croutons and ranch. That's a true story. Either we have totally failed or we're advancing. I don't know what's happening. There's a whole industry about clean living. There are detoxed, I looked at the internet this week. Look for detox diets. Look for diets that are going to flush those toxins out of you. There's a $50 billion cosmetic industry out there that's going to help you clean up your skin. Think about some of the most popular shows on television or Netflix. It's home organization shows. And you could say, well, that's about health, but like, I think something deeper is going on. I think we want to feel clean. I think we're trying to attack it from the outside. Take example, social media. How much energy do we spend trying to give an impression that we are clean on the outside, that our family life is great, and that our marriage is great, and that our vacation is great, and everything we eat is great, and I'm great? But does it ever really get to the deepest recesses? When you post that on social media, does it work for very long? Does it really make you feel clean for very long? Or do you have to keep scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing? Think about call-out culture on the internet. I think call-out culture is actually doing a lot of what fundamentalism does in religion. It's looking around for someone whose hands are more soiled than yours so you can call them out, so you can feel better, so you can feel a little bit more justified. It is a way to feel okay, to feel clean, to try to scrub off the guilt that you have. But it only works for a little while. After you call out one person, you're going to have to call out another person and another person, because you're going to have to keep cleaning and keep scrubbing and keep scrubbing and keep scrubbing. My point is, whether it's through religion or food or detoxes or clean living or social media or call-out culture, we spend a massive amount of energy trying to clean ourselves up from the outside. And remember, the Pharisees had good intentions. Things I mentioned, going to church regularly, trying to be discerning about what you allow in your house, trying to care for your physical body, trying to call out injustice, none of them are bad. But Jesus says that's not going to work. You can scrub and scrub and scrub, but you're still not going to feel clean. An outside-in approach doesn't work. There's a line in Shakespeare's Macbeth where Macbeth says to the doctor, "Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased? Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased?" Who can minister to a diseased heart and mind? Who can cleanse us on the deepest level? Who can cleanse us from the inside out? There's a Sandra McCracken song called Doxology, which is based on a couple verses from the book of Jude. And the song begins, "To him who is able to keep you from falling, to him, to him, to him, to him." And the next line is this. This is one I want you to hear. "We are standing in his presence with our garments clean and white." We are standing in his presence with our garments clean and white. If I'm totally honest, I've heard a lot of language growing up about clean garments, and I always found it kind of turned me off. And for the first time, when I heard McCracken in her honest and vulnerable voice sing that line, and not some kind of overly pious TV preacher, it made me think, I want that. I want to stand in his presence with garments that are clean and white. If I'm totally honest with you, yeah, I do want to be clean, and I want to be white. Who's able to do that? who can minister to a diseased heart? Who's been cleansing in the unclean throughout this entire story of Mark's gospel? Who has healed and restored and made clean and saved the unclean woman who has bled for 12 years? Who has cleansed the unclean leper and restored him to the faith of community? Who has touched a dead corpse, a 12-year-old girl, and raised her to life? Who can cleanse that which is unclean? Who is it that makes possible for us, despite our defilement, to stand in God's presence with garments clean and white? It's Jesus. In our story, Jesus will make a turn in chapter 8, and he will move relentlessly to the cross. And he will move to die a death. And through that death, he will absorb the defilement, the uncleanness of not just a few people in Galilee in the first century, but the whole world, including those of us sitting in Northeast Ohio in 2020. So you can scrub and scrub and scrub and scrub from the outside through your religion, through your clean living, but the only one that has the power to make you clean is Jesus.